And it's July 17th, Friday on KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas filling in for Roger this morning on the local news hour. We did have one crash reported in about the last 5 minutes there on eastbound Interstate 80 between Kimball Junction and Silver Creek Junction. The right shoulder is blocked, and there looks to be a slight delay growing in that area around the eastbound 80 exit onto eastbound slash southbound U.S. Highway 40. But that is not out of the ordinary for the morning commute hours. Other than that, I don't see any major traffic to be aware of in the Wasatch back. Currently 60 degrees in the Park City area and 64 in Heber. With more on the weather, we have Cedric Haynes from ABC.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday as we move into the weekend. Well, let's talk about that forecast. A mixture of clouds and sunshine for your Friday. Warm and sticky conditions out there. Temperatures in the mid-80s for highs in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing to around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. Now, as we get into the afternoon hours, we're going to see a good chance of those pop-up showers and thunderstorms developing. They could produce some torrential downpours, isolated flash flood risk. But overall, downpours, lightning, and gusty winds will be possible. Now, as we go into tonight, those showers and storms will fade out fairly quickly. And then as we start off your day on Saturday, it will start dry. So your first half of your Saturday looks pretty dry out there. Temperatures starting off in the 50s. But as we go into the afternoon hours, we'll see those highs climbing into the mid-80s in Park City. Highs around 90 in the Heber Valley. And yes, we're going to have another good chance of those pop-up afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Again, not a washout. No need to cancel your weekend plans on Saturday or Sunday. But there will be the chance of those afternoon pop-up showers and storms that could produce some torrential downpours. At least for a half hour to an hour or so before they move on. As we move into your Sunday, as I mentioned, we'll keep that chance of those afternoon pop-up showers and storms. Highs in the mid-80s over towards Park City. Highs will be in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Heading into next week, the monsoon moisture, that pattern really hangs tough across the Beehive State. So as we go into your Monday, showers and thunderstorms during the afternoon hours, fairly likely. We'll continue that trend into your Tuesday afternoon, a good chance of those afternoons, showers and thunderstorms developing. Same story for your Wednesday, a really good chance of those showers and storms developing in the afternoon hours. So temperatures, because of that, will start to continue to slowly cool down. We'll go from the upper 80s for highs on Monday to highs down into the low 80s by the middle of next week in Park City. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley will go from those highs in the low 90s to highs in the upper 80s by the weekend. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And air quality around the Wasatch Back and Wasatch Front today is acceptable. Coming up later on the show, it is jam-packed. We'll be speaking with the U.S. Forest Service, checking in on the Buck Basin fire burning southeast of Heber in Wasatch County. And then we'll speak with SUA's Executive Director, Scott Braden, on the recent reduction of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. The president of the Charleston Community Heritage Foundation will join us to talk about that town's Pioneer Day festivities. And then we'll speak with our very own GM and CEO, Juliana Alley, and Development Director Sarah Irvin on 1 year since losing federal funding for public media and a fundraising update. It's coming up on the local news hour, and at 9, we'll have the community campfire every Friday. We're hitting the trails, airwaves, and the stage this week. Amber Johnson rides with the new Utah chapter of the Expeditionary Veterans Association to discover how mountain biking is helping veterans reconnect, build community, and heal. Andrea Buchanan sits down with KPCW volunteer DJ Heidi Bretz to uncover the fascinating story behind one of the voices on our air, from a career in tech and a childhood connected to the FBI to her love of discovering new music. Coach Bill Skinner has all the local and national sports you need, and this week's Campfire Music Sesh features members of the Egyptian Youth Theater cast performing two songs from Shrek Jr. live in our studio. That's today at 9 a.m. after the local news hour. Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioners praised a proposed mixed-use development in Silver Creek this week, but wonder what's taking so long. Columbus Pacific Development Partner Tony Tyler will head to the Summit County Council for a rezone after getting planners to buy into his Crossroads at Silver Creek project. Tyler has dialed back the housing density since first applying to develop the northwest corner of Interstate 80 and Silver Creek Road in early 2023. The version moving forward includes 90 housing units with a park and clubhouse, 4,000 square foot nonprofit building, and 32,000 square feet of other commercial space. Before voting in favor Tuesday, Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Matt Nagy commented on how long Summit County has been considering Tyler's application.
Years and years and years is too long for anyone to be waiting on anything from the government.
The Planning Commission giving the development a positive recommendation after a public hearing. Comments from residents of the nearby neighborhood where Tyler himself lives were mixed. Most opposed the project because they worried it would change the character of the area for the worse. 20 of the 90 units would be affordable apartments, and most of the market rate units would be for sale townhomes. Tyler has said he'd like PC Tots, where he is a board member, to use the nonprofit space for childcare. The county council will ultimately decide whether to rezone Tyler's 14 acres and sign a development agreement. He's also asking for reduced setbacks in places because of the parcel's triangular shape. Tyanne Mooney says she's the only person still on the Planning Commission since Tyler first proposed Crossroads, calling the latest iteration much better than before.
This should never take 4 years. So we really need to find a better way, and maybe you can work with council and say, we don't want to make people wait this long to have to come through so many hoops.
Tyler says Summit County currently requires near construction level documents to apply for a rezone, front loading both time and cost. And in the case of Crossroads, he's revised his application at least 3 times in response to density concerns. The county planning department is proposing changes it says will make rezones easier on all involved. That may also facilitate another Columbus Pacific project a few miles away on the Klein Dolly property in Jeremy Ranch. That's where Tyler is separately partnering with Summit County to build affordable housing, a fire station, and new field house for Basin Rec. The Summit County Council was scheduled to discuss and vote on a new rezoning process July 8th, but delayed the item. Planners recommend requiring less detail from developers earlier in the process. And Columbus Pacific and Summit County are financial supporters of this radio station. In other news, the Park City Community Foundation's Women's Giving Fund has announced 3 recipients for its 2026 high-impact grants. KPCW's Ula Britt Libre reports how the $150,000 awarded will benefit the community.
The Women's Giving Fund selected the Summit County Clubhouse as its top awardee, receiving a $90,000 high-impact grant. The funds given annually to benefit the lives of women and children in Summit County were awarded at a grant celebration at Park City Mountains Legacy Lodge July 15th. The Summit County Clubhouse says it helps people with mental health and substance use challenges to build connected and stable lives. Vulnerable individuals join the nonprofit as members and volunteer to help the facility run with the goal of returning to the workforce. The grant money will be used to expand its emergency housing fund and work program. Executive Director Jen O'Brien says the funds come at a critical time for the clubhouse. Since she took the helm in 2023, she says membership has increased by 300%, totaling around 110 people.
This grant will strengthen our capacity, which is bursting at the seams. We've been small, we've grown fast. My hope is that we'll be able to scale up to meet the growth that we're seeing.
O'Brien says over half of the clubhouse members are women, but that the funds will help the ripple effects of health and addiction crisis across the Wasatch Back.
So the stability that we can create through the clubhouse model, through returning people back into the workforce, through keeping them stably housed, regardless of the gender, that has a really big impact on the women and the children in our community.
The 2,400-plus members of the Women's Giving Fund and the Initiative Steering Committee voted on the grant recipients. The group selected 2 other nonprofits for its high-impact grants. PC Reads and St. Mary's Catholic Church each received $30,000. Committee member Ketzel Morales says 22 nonprofits applied for the Women's Giving Fund impact grant this year. The final 3 were chosen based on community impact.
every single one of those nonprofits is going to serve their purpose with the grants that they got in order to better support like the community of Park City. So I'm really excited to just see how that's going to trickle into their programming and the people that they serve.
The Park City Community Foundation aims to address the area's social needs and build community through a thriving workforce and a sustainable future. Since its inception in 2007, the foundation has brought more than $82 million in total impact to Park City and Summit County. Previous recipients of the Women's Giving Fund High Impact Grantee include Wasatch Immigration Project, the People's Health Clinic, and PC Tots. Application for next year's Women's Giving Fund opened in the spring. Ulibert Libre, KPCW News.
On the phone with us now from the U.S. Forest Service is spokesperson Brenda Bushell. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor.
So we're bringing you in for an update on the Buck Basin fire. This is about 15 miles southeast of the Heber area. Did the rain help? What are the sort of updated containment and acreage numbers?
So currently we're sitting at 145 acres with 64% containment. And yes, the rains have helped significantly. We have taken a lot of rain in and around the fire. But with that came the lightning, and so we've had to pull crews off for safety, and so it's kind of a happy medium, and hopefully we don't have any other lightning strikes that start up due to that.
Yes, I did see the Forest Service post on Facebook about extra lightning on top of this already lightning-caused fire. You know, what does that do to, why is there a safety concern? I know that might be obvious, but is it starting new fires? Is it that lightning could threaten the firefighters themselves?
Yes, as firefighter safety is our top priority, so we have pulled off crews each afternoon when the showers have rolled in with the thunder and lightning that comes with it. The other thing is it was a lightning strike fire, and some with a lightning strike fire, it could take a week for that fire to all of a sudden show visible enough that we can see it. And that's kind of what happened with this one is there was no lightning in the area the day that it started, but it had been in the previous week. And that's what we kind of watch for now is that, okay, it may not pop its head right now, but it might in a week. So we'll be taking a look at different areas to make sure that we don't have any other strikes that have all of a sudden shown up.
That's true, because I remember with, I believe it was the Yellow Lake fire, upon further investigation, it had started a day earlier than we initially thought because it can smolder for a little bit. How do you look for those types of hot spots during the firefighting process?
So we have had a lot of aerial help. We've had a lot of flights that have gone over looking for possible heat. But a lot of those that lay under canopy that we can't see, it just takes a little while and somebody will actually, most time it's the public that see smoke and then they give us a call.
Gotcha. So this is in the National Forest, southeast of Heber, as I mentioned. Could you describe the area more for those who haven't maybe gone recreating in that part of the forest and maybe what the terrain is like as far as firefighting strategy?
So the terrain is a lot of rolling hills with higher elevation and big basins, and that's what this fire is in. It's in a big basin. We have a lot of timber cells in and around this area, so that's a something that we're trying to protect so that the fire doesn't get out. And in that area where we have the logging sales, it's a lot of grazing. We have cow and sheep permits out there, so we have a lot of animals that are out there as well. One thing that is playing towards our favor is with these larger basins, we have open meadows. And our open meadows still have a lot of green grass, and that is holding the fire. The fire is not progressing into those meadows, which is saving a lot of the movement of the fire. As well with that is our aspens still have a lot of moisture from the winter, and so our aspens are not combusting either. It's just the dead conifers that are in there that are burning right now. So the terrain is helping us immensely on this fire, and withholding some of the moisture that we had from the winter, it's still pretty green up there.
And obviously no structures in the area are still threatened?
Correct. It's out in the middle of a good spot where we don't have structures like some of the other fires that are happening in the state.
Yeah, the Forest Service got an interesting question on its Facebook from a commenter. I don't know if he's a listener, but he was, I guess, remembering that there used to be a policy if a fire was naturally caused and not threatening any structures, that the focus on firefighting wouldn't be so much extinguishing as just making sure it doesn't go the wrong way, letting it kind of be like a, you know, unintentionally started controlled burn, so to speak. Could you speak to that policy, if that was ever in place, and if that counts here?
Whenever we have a fire start, our agency administrators kind of look at that and see before we even start suppression. This year is a unique year with all of the fires that are going on, that there is still the suppression more so than the let fire do what fire should do on the landscape. So that's always a conversation with the agency administrators to see how they're going to deal with the fire. But this year, with everything going on, everything is a full suppression right now.
Gotcha. And, you know, you mentioned the widespread fire danger and so many fires burning down south and in Colorado as well. Did you have enough firefighters to work this fire at first? Since some of the fires have died down in southern Utah, what is staffing like, and what was staffing like earlier in the summer?
So there is a lot of firefighters out and about, and a lot of air support. We were able to get air support fairly quickly onto the fire, and we did have some of the larger air support, the scoopers and that did work a couple shifts on the fire. Per se, in personnel, we were sitting about 150. So that was a lot, a pretty good start to this fire. Now, we kind of had the moisture, which helped us out a lot, that we didn't have to do a lot of the work because of the rain, which was really good. But we have had a lot of crews down in there taking out the dead snags and starting the mop up around the perimeter, and they have done great work down in the basin to help prevent the spread as well.
You know, where are the firefighters from? Is it a lot of local Utah personnel or across the country?
We have both. We have quite a few of the local resources that are here, and then we have had crews from elsewhere. So it just kind of depended on which fire they were at, but we've had both.
And again, the update on containment being 65%, about 145 acres, if I got that right. And are the closures still the same since we last got an update?
Yes.
Gotcha. So that's Red Creek Mountain Road.
The Red Mountain.
And Low Pass.
And Low Pass.
All right, and the west side of Current Creek Road as well. Brenda Bushell from the U.S. Forest Service, is there anything else you'd like to mention as far as the Buck Basin or firefighting in general goes?
We just want to thank everybody who's come out and supported, and appreciate the general public for staying out of the closure area so that the firefighters are safe, and just continue to have a safe summer.
All right, thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Connor.
An unfinished condo development at Canyons Village will be up for auction July 22nd. After the developer went into default on a $30 million loan, the Ascent Park City is part of Hilton's Tapestry Collection and broke ground years ago. The Salt Lake Tribune reporting the building still isn't complete, and would-be residents are worried about their deposits. The owners owe nearly $200,000 in property taxes on the development, while contracts claim more than $14 million in unpaid invoices. As of last week, it was expected to open in October 2027. Another delay from October, when Hilton anticipated it might open in the final quarter of this year. And residents opposed to lift upgrades at Park City Mountain made their case before an administrative hearing officer yesterday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the officer now has 15 business days to grant or deny the appeal.
Park City's administrative hearing officer, Tim Pack, reviewed an appeal of two applications to upgrade Park City Mountain's Silver Lode Eagle and Eaglet chairlifts Thursday. One application will expand the Silver Lode Express from a 6-passenger detachable lift to one that carries 8 passengers. The other will replace the 30-year-old Eagle and Eaglet chairlifts with a 6-passenger detachable chairlift and Mid-Mountain station. The Park City Planning Commission approved the upgrades May 27th. 6 Park City area residents appealed the decision June 8th. PAC now has until August 6th to grant or deny the appeal. Appellants believe the Planning Commission unlawfully ignored evidence the changes would contribute to unsafe and overcrowded conditions on terrain served by Silver Lode and Eagle. Their appeal says commissioners should have factored in comfortable carrying capacity, which measures how many skiers and riders the mountain can manage. Hiram Bosserman is an attorney for the appellants. He said the resort has already admitted the upgrades could be harmful to guests in its application by detailing how to mitigate traffic and parking.
They have determined that there is a detrimental impact generated by the lift's construction and its operation, such that they needed a plan and such that that plan provides a workable means with dealing with that impact. We can't determine whether parking is mitigated without a CCC analysis.
CCC figured prominently in Park City Mountain's first attempt to upgrade Silverlode, Eagle, and Eaglet in 2022. Four residents eventually overturned the planning department's initial approval and kickstarted 3 years of litigation. A key difference is the 2022 application was submitted under an administrative process that required CCC information. It also gave the city's planning director the final say rather than the planning commission. Park City Municipal Attorney Laura Swenson said conditional use permits, on the other hand, don't require CCC data.
The plain language of the development agreement does not require a CCC analysis or any other independent criteria for the CUP other than what's required by the code.
PAC's review is limited to information from Planning Commission meetings, including public comments, along with the hearing arguments from attorneys for the appellants, Park City Mountain, and the city. Park City Municipal and Vail Resorts Epic Promise Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Coming up this weekend, there are some road work projects to be aware of in and around Kimball Junction. Summit County drivers may experience lane closures and detours tonight as crews repave roads around the area. New Park Boulevard and Silver Creek Road in Silver Creek Estates will be closed at 10 p.m. Friday. The repaving work is expected to be completed by tomorrow morning. Also today, the Utah Department of Transportation says crews will repave the east side of State Route 224 and remove the old northbound lane striping. Starting on Monday, there will be two left turn lanes onto westbound Ute Boulevard from State Route 224 in Kimball Junction. Joining us on the phone from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance is Executive Director Scott Braden. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Connor. Good to be here.
So, SUA has released a press release this week on the heels of a significant reduction in size to the National Monuments Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, both there in southern Utah. Could you just begin by explaining SUA's opposition to this move by President Donald Trump?
So, SUA believes that Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, the group that where I work, that President Trump acted unlawfully to reduce the size of the national monuments on Monday. And just to give a sense of scale for your listeners, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was 1.9 million acres. President Trump reduced it by over 90% to 181,000 acres. Bears Ears National Monument was 1.35 million million acres. And that was reduced also by over 90% to a mere 121,000 acres. At the same time, eliminating the intertribal commission that was helping to manage the Bears Ears National Monument. So the scale and the outrage of President Trump's action kind of combined with the fact that he was doing it at the behest of Governor Cox, Senator Mike Lee, and the rest of the Utah delegation really grounds our opposition because it completely cut out the public from the process. It cut out input from the tribes, and we just think it's a complete outrage.
And I want to get to that intertribal commission that you mentioned in a moment because that is a significant part of this. But just lingering on the map, I encourage people, if they are able, to look up just a map of the before and after here. And there is some history of under the Obama administration, Bears Ears being created, shrunk in Trump 1, restored in the Biden era, and now being shrunk more significantly in Trump 2. Grand Staircase is a little bit older, 1996, created by Clinton. But what do you make of the new maps? Because they're not contiguous. Parts of it look like Morse code. Is it random? Do you have any insight into why the maps now look the way they do?
We really don't. I mean, it's a bit of a head scratcher because when President Trump did this before in 2017, the cuts were still severe, but they were somewhat smaller, 2 million instead of 3 million acres this time. And so the rationale for why things look the way they do just kind of falls apart the more you kind of look at it. In the president's new proclamations, they talk about the kind of objects or values that they want to protect, whether those be indigenous cultural sites or paleontological sites. And when you look at the maps, you know that those values are spread across a much larger area. And even in President Trump's 2017 reduction, we're in a much smaller or in different areas. So there's really no rhyme or reason, and it kind of falls apart the harder you look at it.
You know, could you talk about what shrinking means? Maybe this is sort of a stupid question, but the land hasn't disappeared. Is it still managed by the BLM? Is it still publicly accessible? Would that change depending on where the monuments settle after this kind of ping-ponging back and forth?
It's a great question, Connor, and it's really about how the land is going to be managed, honestly. You're absolutely right. It was public land before President Clinton or Obama designated the monuments respectively. It is public land now. These two monuments have always been managed by the Bureau of Land Management. So that doesn't change. It's really about opening up these areas that were protected for cultural resources, for recreation, for what their wild values, paleontological values, stripping away the protections that the national monuments offered. And what that looks like on the ground is opening up these lands for potential mining. So one of the protections of a national monument is it withdraws the area from the mineral laws. So people can't stake claims and develop potentially mining operations. And I have to point out, you know, the mining opportunities based on when we saw this shrinking of the monuments in 2017 and just historically, it's pretty marginal in Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. So we're not talking about like large resources, mineral resources that companies are clamoring to get to. But it's going to allow people to stake claims and maybe start to try to think about developing things on the ground. It also tilts the balance towards more logging, more intensive grazing, more roads, more motorized type of access, more cell towers, and just sort of like industrial types of developments on the land. That's the kind of change that I think we will see to these lands. And frankly, we're going to fight it. We're going to fight at SUA and with our coalition partners and with our friends in the tribes who we're supporting. We're going to fight Trump's illegal reduction of these monuments in the courts, and we're going to oppose any projects on the ground along the way and defend the land.
Yeah, and you alluded to earlier, before the executive order, these national monuments contained sites sacred to a lot of First Peoples, indigenous tribes in the area. And when Bears Ears was created, along came the Bears Ears Commission that included representatives of five tribes in that area to kind of cooperatively, I don't know, maybe you could help me with the right word, govern or manage the land with the federal government. And that was groundbreaking at the time. Could you talk about what that commission did and the significance of it now going away along with much of the boundaries of Bears Ears?
I think that's one of the more callous elements of Monday's action is the erasure of tribal voices from the management of these monuments, Bears Ears in particular, which, as you described, had this intertribal commission that was charged with helping the BLM and the Forest Service, which are the two agencies that manage different parts of Bears Ears, to develop a management plan that integrates traditional knowledge and other inputs from the tribes in a really deeply meaningful way that sometimes gets called co-management. And Bears Ears really broke new ground in that regard in a way that was profoundly meaningful to the tribes I think is a bit of reconciliation and justice in a really important way. And just to way that the Utah delegation and President Trump thumbed their nose at that, I think is deeply shameful.
Yeah. So who are your allies then in fighting this? Because obviously the congressional delegation tends to support public lands in state hands as opposed to the federal government. You mentioned, you know, you're going to be litigating this. What other resources are you tapping?
Well, I think that the most important resource that we're tapping, I mean, we operate in coalition with other conservation groups and with recreation groups. We're standing in solidarity with the communities around Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, many of whom have built their economies around an expectation that these places will be protected. So we stand with those business leaders and community leaders that are bracing for chaos. We stand with the tribes, as we've talked about, and you know, just really wanting to support indigenous communities through this process. But I think one of the most important aspects is that we stand with the people. And that is, I think, the most important thing to think about in regards to this action. You know, recent polling showed that over 70% of Utahns support the protection and preservation of both of these national monuments. When you back out to the entire West, the number's over 90%. So people across the nation, and in Utah in particular, deeply support these national monuments as they were, as protected places. And I think you only have to look at the secretive, sort of sneaky nature of how this came out of nowhere on Monday. You know, nobody announced this. None of the senators, Senator Lee, Senator Curtis, Governor Cox, none of their calendars indicated that this was coming. It was very, very tight-lipped. And I think that shows you that they know that this is a deeply, deeply unpopular action.
I want to move on to maybe getting as granular as you can about potential and existing litigation over, usually when it comes to these national monuments, the Antiquities Act. That's a 1906 law that gives the president, the courts have interpreted it as giving the president's power to protect land by designating it as a national monument or some other designation. That has also been the subject of litigation when it comes to presidents removing those protections, as has happened in this case. What is now the status? Like, the previous ping-ponging that we've described is not done in the courts. You know, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals revived a few Utah counties' lawsuits over when President Biden restored the boundaries when he came into office. So how does this move by Trump to shrink them even more affect that lawsuit and set the stage for what you're saying you might file as a new lawsuit?
It's a good question. So broadly, but before I answer the specifics, it's our position, and I think the language of the Antiquities Act is pretty clear, that it gives the president, it delegates to the president, the power to create national monuments, but not to shrink them or eliminate them. So that's why and how we ground our argument that the president has acted unlawfully in reducing the monuments, both in 2017 and now here in 2026. I should just also point out that since it was passed in 1906, presidents of both parties have used the Antiquities Act to protect landscape scale national monuments, to protect a broad range of values, including four of the Mighty Five in Utah national parks got their start, in fact, as national monuments. When it comes to the legal cases, there's two buckets, basically, of cases. One that you mentioned that was recently in the 10th Circuit is the state of Utah and other plaintiffs arguing that President Biden did not have the power to restore the monuments. We think that case is, you know, likely, we don't think there's any there after President Trump's action, because the plaintiffs have basically gotten what they wanted. So we kind of expect that case to wind down and basically maybe end soon. The other case that you mentioned was the one that conservation groups such as SUA and others filed in 2017, or well, after the 2017 action by President Trump to reduce the monuments for the first time. in federal district court in Washington, D.C. That case is still sort of in a suspended state that may be reactivated. We may, you know, file a new case. I don't know. You know, I'm going to leave it to our attorneys to determine and our coalition partners to determine sort of the best path forward legally. But we will be answering this in the courts because we do believe that this was unlawful.
Yeah, I'm. Thank you for talking about what you think the Antiquities Act does, because in my head, it seems like there might be a risk going after this decision by President Trump under the Antiquities Act, because should you change the court's interpretation of it, are you worried about that affecting the ability to create further national monuments or affecting the boundaries of current ones that were created in the same way?
Yes, I mean, that is absolutely a consideration. I mean, clearly this Supreme Court has shown an appetite for overturning precedent. So I think that that's a hazard that we are taking into account along with our partners as we think about the legal response to this action.
All right, we're almost out of time, but I want to bring it back out to sort of a bird's eye view, and maybe you could just speak to your own personal relationship with the areas that these national monuments used to cover and some of the landscape and how they're doing after some of the recent fires. I know the Babylon Fire was in the area of Bears Ears.
Right. Until recently, the Babylon Fire raging on Elk Ridge and in the Abajos in the heart of the, until Monday, boundaries of Bears Ears National Monument. You know, it looks like that fire is largely contained at this point, or closer to being contained, and I'm grateful for that. But the fact that the president would take this action, you know, while firefighters are risking their lives and while land managers are on the ground fighting those fires, I think shows a heightened degree of callousness. So personally, I find it outrageous. I'm sad. This is a part of our public lands that, as a Utahn, I've spent a lot of time on these landscapes, and I find it deeply sad. And so that's why I'll be joining you know, folks from, I think, all over the state on Monday, July 20th, for a monumental day of action. We're going to be organizing protests in Salt Lake City and cities across Utah. If folks want to find out more about that, they can go to suwa.org, suwa.org, to find out details if you want to get involved and turn out on Monday.
All right. That's where we'll have to leave it. Scott Braden, thank you so much for coming on air with us.
Thanks. It's good to be with you, Connor.
That's Scott Braden. He's the executive director of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. In the studio now from the Charleston Community Heritage Foundation, we have Jana Brown and Jessica Shepherd. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So Pioneer Day coming up in about, well, exactly a week from today in Charleston. Like many of us do celebrate the annual traditions. What does Charleston do that's special?
So we start the day out with some really big booms so we can wake the whole town up. And then we get them up and ready to go and stretched out. And they do a 5K run. And you can register for that on our website, which is all of the different activities through the day. We then have a breakfast, so we can, you know, you can run and then relax and have some breakfast. And then we have vendors and food trucks moving in while the breakfast is completing. And then we have different other activities, including entertainment. We have a new splash and catch. And I'll have Jessica kind of mention a little bit more about that.
So we have some fish that are coming in, and it's a fun new event that we're bringing in for kids to catch fish, and they'll just come in and enjoy catching fish. Mm-hmm. We also have a car show earlier in the day, in the early morning. After that, we have some kids' games, tethered balloon rides with weather dependent. Mm-hmm.
We also have an auction, so you could do a silent auction if you don't want to be there for the live auction. And that's in between the entertainment as well. Bounce houses, face painting, Just really trying to capture and keep that small town feel at the same time.
It's activities galore, it sounds like.
Yes.
And I want to mention for the listeners, the splash and grab that you mentioned is catching fish with your hands.
Yes.
So
yes.
I hope to see some videos of that. I wanted to ask about your laser light show since, you know, it's a bummer with fireworks and the fire danger, but obviously precautions are, it's important to safety first and everything with the celebrations. How did you decide to project lasers onto tethered hot air balloons?
So we are working with Balloons Above, and they have a silver balloon that they're going to bring in, which will really help accent the show, which is going to be amazing. You will have to be in the park to see it, essentially. Unfortunately, we have never had to cancel fireworks since the Pioneer Day began in 1900. Yeah.
The year 1900.
So this major pivot was very new to us. So we just think that a lot of people will come out and just celebrate within the park. We are having a parade at 6 p.m. as well, just a little small town parade that will end at the park. So it kind of just draws everybody there to enjoy the whole day. And of course, we'll have entertainment headliners that are local from Lee's Music. They are a local company that promotes music in Heber Valley itself. And so we're just really excited to have everybody come and just enjoy.
Has Charleston celebrated Pioneer Day annually since 1900? I think I had in my notes 1956.
Yeah.
So we discovered the first one began on record in 1900. They paused around World War II time frame and Great Depression, but then continued annually since 1956.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yep. And it's looked different through the years, of course, but fireworks and getting up and raising the flag has always been part of that.
Cool. So who's the celebration for, and is it free? Do they need to get tickets for any parts of it?
Yes. So you will need to get tickets for the splash and grab and the 5K. And you can register for the auction. We're actually going to have numbers so that with paddles, so you can actually use your paddle in the live auction, which is awesome. And that website that you can register for all of the those different events is cchfutah.org.
All right. And where does the auction money go? Does it benefit the city?
Money, or? So it goes into our foundation, and we're raising money to help with grants to help beautify Charleston and keep its heritage. So all of that will go back into the community for different events and to keep the 24th going year after year.
And to help with, we recently received a grant for historical heritage preservation. So we are beginning our work on some filming and some audios that we can do for our community as well.
Great. Well, anything else that you'd like to mention ahead of Pioneer Day next week?
Just come on out. It's supposed to be great weather, we're hoping, fingers crossed. And then, just sign up for whatever you can. Go and visit the different vendors. There are a lot of free opportunities while you're there, and just enjoy with your families.
All right. We've been speaking with Jana Brown, the president of the Charleston Community Heritage Foundation, along with Secretary Jessica Shepherd. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Two Utahns are suing celebrity investor Kevin O'Leary for defamation after he labeled them Chinese agents while defending the Box Elder data center proposal. Utah News Dispatch reporting that Joshua Cantor, founder of the nonprofit Alliance for a Better Utah, and Gabrielle Finlayson of the political firm Elevate Strategies filed the suit Wednesday. They claim the businessman of Shark Tank fame and the Fox News television network both led a, quote, weeks-long smear campaign against them. While O'Leary did not immediately respond to the Utah News Dispatch's request for comment at O'Leary Digital, a Fox News Media spokesperson provided a prepared statement saying Fox News Media publicly corrected the record on every program where on-air guest Kevin O'Leary's comments were made, all of which was extensively publicized. The network says it will, quote, vigorously defend against the lawsuit. And O'Leary corrected his claims last month, saying in a social media post that he has no evidence Cantor Finlayson or their organizations were funded by China. The lawsuit filed in federal court in Salt Lake City alleges he did so after he received their legal demand for a retraction, and it notes Fox News covered the development, issuing an apology for the error. Here in the studio with, and as I mentioned on the noon show yesterday, a somewhat unhappy anniversary, the loss of federal funding, but an update on fundraising and community support, we have President and CEO of KPCW, Juliana Alley, and Development Director, Sarah Irvin. Thank you both for coming on with me.
Sure. Good morning, Connor.
So what was the impact when Congress clawed back funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds numerous public media stations, radio and TV, both across the country? What was the impact here locally?
Here locally, it impacted KPCW pretty significantly. That funding was about 14% of our budget and something that we'd had for decades. And it was very reliable funding that money that we received from the federal government via CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Portions of it were restricted, but the bulk of it was unrestricted. So we were able to spend those dollars on salaries, fringe benefits, professional development, the electricity to run the station, new equipment, you know, anything and everything, community engagement activities. So that funding was really critical to KPCW.
Can you get specific about things that you've had to cut? Obviously, we have not cut the electricity, as you can hear right now. But what are some things that, you know, we and the community have lost because of this?
Fortunately, we did not lose anything. We modified programming a little bit, and we've had to tighten our belts a bit more with some of our internal budgets, but we did not have to cut any staff. We did not have to pull back on community events that we're attending. If anything, we're able to attend some more remote activities and broadcasts this summer. But that's mostly because of more fiscal responsibility, not that we weren't responsible before, but again, just trying to be more cognizant about how we're spending those dollars. But the biggest reason we haven't had to cut anything is because of individual fundraising. The community really stepped up for us a year ago with generous donations, leveling up if they were a Broadcaster Club member, just really recognizing that this is community radio and that the community needs to and wants to support us.
Yeah, and that there was a significant amount of emergency fundraising 1 year ago, and you're kind of reviving that effort, right, Sarah?
We are, and you've probably heard some of our lost and found messaging. You know, one of the things that makes KPCW so unique is the hyper-local nature of our programming. 90% of what you hear on these airwaves every weekday is locally produced. It's local news, it's local updates, local traffic, local weather, local services like the Lost and Found Report. And so, last year, we lost funding, and in response to that, we found a lot of new support from listeners out there who maybe hadn't given to KPCW before. And this time around, we are asking you to renew your support, if you can, even increase your support. So we've weathered 1 year of that loss of federal funding, but we are in year two. And as Juliana mentioned, it was 2 years worth of funding that we had budgeted around, and we are continuing to have to make adjustments. One thing I'll mention that, you know, we did cut was a lot of our fundraising events. So while we didn't cut community public events, we did cut some of our Broadcasters Club events. We've scaled them back because we know that our major donors want us to be good stewards of the money that we have. So apologies out there to those that have missed some of our parties because we have cut those back, but we're doing that because we want to be very responsible with the funds that we have.
I feel less guilty about not using my gym membership now.
Okay. Well, for me, this morning was a really great example, like it is every morning when I got the local this morning. The top three stories that are in the local this morning are about fire, traffic, and how AI is impacting the Wasatch Back. Those are the things that your dollars are funding, those stories that Connor, Grace, Christine, our newest reporter, Ula Britt, are reporting on, the packages that Sydney and Emma, our digital team, are putting together. That information and that outreach is as Sarah has been saying, is local and is the information you need to know as a resident, someone who recreates in the Wasatch Back or works in the Wasatch Back. You need to stay engaged with KPCW, and please support KPCW.
So the fundraising campaign is kind of capitalizing on one of the other great services we offer, which is the lost and found.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So when we lost funding, but we found you.
Found
you'll
yours.
Be hearing from us. You'll be hearing from us all week long. And you know, you can make a gift now. One of the things we're hoping people will share when they donate is what they have found thanks to KPCW, whether it was a lost dog or maybe it was their new favorite, you know, musician that they'd never heard before, but our local DJs play. So you can make your gift, and with your gift online, leave us a message. Let us know what you found thanks to KPCW. You can donate at kpcw.org.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. This is community radio, powered by the community and programmed by the community. If there's things you want to hear, a news story that you have an idea about, you know, just let us know. The app is a great way to engage with us. There's a feature called Tell KPCW that you can let us know about something that's happening in town, something you want us to cover. Make a song request. That, I think, you can just call the KPCW
DJ
line, right? Yeah.
That's because we're so local.
Yes.
Thanks both for coming on.